Joe Farinaccio from OutRigMedia.com, and I have Jim Brown on the phone with me this week. Little impromptu phone call. How you doing, Jim?
Hello, Joe, and hello to all you outriggers.
Yeah, you just got back from a trip up in the Northeast here. You've been to Rhode Island and Massachusetts, as far as I can remember. Is that true?
Yes, it's not yet spring up there. The trees are not leafing out, and I was cold for a week.
I bet. So I know that you've got Outrigger Capercast news for us, and I know that you've got stuff to share from your travels up there. There's a reason why you went up there, and I'd love to hear the story behind it.
Well, okay. It's too bad that I don't have a prepared podcast. I just haven't had time. I got home just today, and I'm hoping that the listeners will understand that this is very impromptu. But I do want to report that Scott Brown and I met in a place called Kingston, Rhode Island, and got together at Bristol, Rhode Island, with the principals of a firm called Fast Forward Composites. And that's exactly what it is. These guys are working with composite materials on a level that I had never seen before. It's been going on for some time in the construction of the America's Cup boats and so forth, but the shop, a great big building there in Bristol, is on a par with the laboratories at the NASA down here in Newport News. I've had a chance to go through the NASA labs, and I'll tell you that this place is not your ordinary boat shop. I'm sorry to say it had taken me this long to really understand what's going on in modern boat building. It is very sophisticated, very expensive, requires a whole new skill set, like this guy Tommy Gonzalez, who is really the director, let's call him the producer of what comes out the door there. He has managed to hire people who have significant backgrounds, some of them on a PhD level with composite science. Composites meaning a combination of carbon fiber, almost exclusively carbon fiber, with epoxy resins and foam cores and honeycomb cores, together with not just vacuum bagging, but they're even moving into autoclaving and extreme temperatures for post-cures. The shop is equipped with an oven, for instance, an oven which, when the several elements of this oven are assembled on a long track, are capable of post-curing the laminate that was laid up in a mold to produce the structural portion of a 70-foot-long leading edge or major D section in the hybrid wing that goes on their prototype number two. Now, I've reported on prototype number one. I've had a chance to see what was on Randy Smythe's boat at the finish of the Everglades Challenge. It was something like I had never seen before, and I've talked about it in the past, but I suppose for those who haven't listened to that, I'd better say that what this wing sail is, it is indeed a hybrid, that is, it has a rigid wing that looks like a giant feather, has the profile view of a feather, but it will also carry sail, that is, sail can be hoisted up on the trailing edge of the feather to increase its area and increase the opportunity to trim the sail together with the wing in order to produce various effects. And the one I saw on Randy's boat was only 30-something feet long. His boat is only 20 feet long. It's a remarkable little trimaran called Scissors. And as I've explained, he has won the Everglades Challenge race, an endurance race, down around the southwest tip of Florida. I think two or three times with this boat. And the fourth time he came in just last month with a different rig than I had seen before. And it's this hybrid wing. It's a very exciting thing because it's practical. And that is, you can leave it up at night. You can leave it up on anchor or at the dock without having to worry about it. You can take the soft portion of the sail off of the trailing edge of the wing and walk away for overnight, which is not the usual case with wing masts. Most wing masts will not rotate into the wind, no matter which direction the wind is coming from. Of course, if the wing can weathercock or weather vane into the wind, it shuts off its power completely. And Randy was able to use that to good advantage during very hard winds in the Everglades Challenge, all at 30 feet. Well, what we saw this week was at 70 feet.
Wow.
It's an enormous thing. Joe, you wouldn't believe it, and very beautiful. The shape of the thing is just elegant. And when I get my graphics together with my sound, all of the stuff that we managed to collect on this trip this past week, I think that we're going to have to include a video as part of the podcast, Joe. We're going to have to show people what we're talking about here because it's very difficult to describe.
Yeah. Well, if we can most certainly do that on the podcast page that hosts that episode.
Would it go to YouTube then? You'd post it on YouTube?
Well, we could perhaps post it on YouTube, and then we'll still be able to, wherever we, whatever the host company is, we should be able to bring that video feed in and just put it right on the page at Outrig Media.
Ah, great. Okay. Well, that's going to be necessary. I don't know about next week because there's something else going on next week.
Yeah.
I'm going down to Cedar Key, and I hope to have a report like this, a telephone report for our listeners.
Oh, yeah, that'll be neat.
So anyway, what Scott and I had a chance to see was the whole shop. These guys have been very protective about their work for the last 2 years until their patent came through. And now they're sort of letting the cat out of the bag, and I consider it a great compliment that they have chosen us to release the cat.
Yeah.
We also had with us Aaron Porter, who is the editor of Professional Boat Builder magazine, and he was also really captivated with what was going on, and I'm going to have a chance to write for Professional Boat Builder an article about this wing. It probably won't be out for 6 months or so, but we have an opportunity to communicate through the podcast in a manner that is much more timely than with a print publication. So let me tell you what we saw there. We saw them moving the new wing out of the shop on a trailer, and it was a high trailer so that the top of the wing could project out over the towing vehicle and keep the length of the whole contraption legal. So they were able to go down the street with this thing, move it over to a shipyard in New Bedford, Mass, without the usual wide load or long load signs and highway patrol escorts and stuff like that. It's legal on the road, but they also had the challenge of getting it into the shipyard at New Bedford and into a shop where they could store it, because just as we got it over there, the weather started to turn nasty. And in that shop, a big, absolutely huge shed at this New Bedford shipyard, they had a 40-foot catamaran. It looks like a beach cat on ultra steroids. If you can imagine a 40-foot-long beach cat, it's a Formula 40 catamaran. There was, and still is, I suppose, a very popular racing class called Formula 40. It's a box rule that limits the length of the vessel to 40 feet. So here they had an older 40-foot racing catamaran onto which they were preparing to install this 70-foot-long rig, rigid wing sail. And there was work to be done on the boat. It was painted. It was almost done, really beautiful, but they had a fair bit of fiddling around to do in order to rig up the bowsprit and the trampolines and so on to get ready to sail. And I'm sorry to say that before they were actually able to get the crane to hoist up the wing and step it on this boat, the weather shut us down. It got to be pretty nasty up there, a little too windy to risk a new contraption like this. And so we did not get to sail, but we're going to go back. Randy Smythe went home, and but he's coming back in a couple of weeks, and we'll be in touch with this fellow Tommy Gonzalez and Randy Smythe as to when they want us to come back and film the initial trials of this prototype number 2, the 70-foot wing.
Wow.
So we had a chance to see all that.
Wow.
And we also had a chance to go through the shop and see the prototype number 3 that's under construction in the shop. It's a 50-foot catamaran with, is it 50 feet or 55? Gosh, I got to get that straight. Anyway, designed by Paul Beaker in Seattle, who is, incidentally, the chief designer for the Oracle Group now, the Ellison syndicate that has been sponsoring the America's Cup competition for several years now. And Paul has designed a boat to receive the next wing, which will be about 90 feet long. And the boat that he's built is not a beach cat. It is a giant day sailor, all right, but it also has a couple of staterooms, one in each hull, and a broad platform between the hulls, a solid platform. It's not trampolines, with seating for about 16 people on theater-type seats, and the helm all located underneath what you'd call a carapace or a marquee that is intended to keep the passengers out of the sun, and it also can be surrounded by the isinglass type curtain in order to keep the spray out, or in case the boat gets going so fast that people are getting wet or it begins to dump rain, they can actually enclose the bridge saloon area of this vessel. And the construction of the thing was just out of sight. I had never seen anything like it. The way they start to build boats like this these days is so different than the way we started out in the old days with a pile of plywood and a truckload of lumber and began whacking out frames and setting them up on a strong back and covering the skeleton with plywood and fiberglass and all that. All of that has gone by. This boat is built in what you might call a laboratory, Joe. It's so clean that except in the sanding booth, I didn't see a crumb of dust in the whole place. Of course, I can't see dust very well. But it was remarkably clean, and and odor-free. The epoxy is kept under vacuum bags and inside of ovens so that the workers don't have to contend with that potentially toxic vapor that you usually see in a boat shop. And, of course, you're not wading through wood shavings and scraps up to your knees. The way it's done is they start by making a plug. Let's look at this 50-foot catamaran bow on. It has bows that aren't really bows to me. They have the same reverse stem appearance as is apparent in the America's Cup vessels now. And Randy Smythe helped me understand what it is about this bow that makes it so different. It's designed as a wave piercer. That is, it's supposed to go through the crests instead of trying to climb over, and thereby allow the vessel to steady down fore and aft. That is, it doesn't cause pitching like our usual boat bows do, which are the higher up you go, the more buoyant they become. And, of course, with the overhang at the stem, it develops a whole lot of buoyancy up forward. Well, what they accomplish all of that needed buoyancy out in the forebody of the hulls by just extending their length and then driving them through the waves. So let's look at this thing bow on and slice it right down the middle of the bridge deck. The vertical centerline plane of the whole ship is where the mold for the underwing and hull begin. So they make a mold for half of the boat, let's say the starboard half of the boat that includes the underwing and only the inboard side of the starboard hull. And that mold starts out as a plug, that is a positive, a male representation of the full-size boat that is carved by a computer-controlled router. The human being doesn't have anything to do with shaping this thing.
Right.
It's all done by a giant five-axis CNC, that is a computer numerically controlled router.
Right.
And they get this big chunk of foam that represents half of the boat, except for the outboard side. And off of that plug, well, it gets a bit of hand sanding and then coating with a mold-creating resin and very finely fared. And off of that, they take a female mold. And all of that is done with by the infused resin process. That is, they'll put down all of the materials that they need for the mold onto the plug, cover it all up with a plastic bag, seal it up around the edges, draw the air out of the plastic bag with a vacuum pump, and at the same time allow the resin to saturate all of the fabric, synthetic fabric that's under the plastic bag. It gets saturated without anybody handling resin. You can't even smell the stuff. And so here's one half of the boat in a mold, and now they in a female mold, and now they go ahead and produce the boat itself in that female mold by laying down first carbon fiber skins, then foam core, then carbon fiber inner skin, and every step of the way it is vacuum bagged down, and it's then post-cured. They get the whole thing hot enough to give the cured resin remarkable physical properties. And what this does is it puts the whole boat on a diet. It can be designed to be so extremely lightweight and so stiff and strong that handling pieces of this stuff is really beyond human experience. So they do the same thing for the port half of the vessel and hook them together down the centerline plane of the bridge deck by actually taping it together with fiberglass. There's a with carbon fiber, rather. And this design is indeed a thing that sort of looks like a like the bee. And hangs down into the tunnel, and a lot of the stresses of resolving the compression load of a wing as it opposes the tensile loads on the headstay and shrouds, a lot of that is absorbed in this pod that protrudes down into the tunnel. It doesn't go all the way to the water line, but it's a big longitudinal girder, hollow girder, And that is what really is used to join the two halves of this vessel together down the vertical center line of the ship, as we say. But now we're looking at a boat that has the inboard sides of the hulls complete, but the outboard sides are wide open. You can walk by at hip height and reach in and work on this thing. So now all the detailing of inserting bulkheads and floors and so on is done without the builders having to climb up a stage and drop down into the hull and try to work in cramped quarters. They can actually build the boat from outside, and after the bulkheading and so on is installed, then another part made from another mold is simply attached to the outboard side of the boat, again using carbon fiber tabbing and vacuum bagging and the whole trip. So we didn't see that. We didn't see the outboard sides of the hulls completed, but we were able to walk down the sides of this thing. And boy, it reminded me, Joe, of when I was trying to learn how to draw perspective drawings. It took me years of practice to learn how to do a so-called X-ray perspective, where the viewer is able to look through the outer skin of the vessel inside and see what was in the boat, both in terms of structure and appointments. And just walking down along the side of this boat was like a moving X-ray perspective, a very beautiful view of how the structure is coming together. They don't expect to be able to launch this boat until August. But by then, they will have the carapace in place. What it is a big marquee that's open on all sides, that's mounted over the bridge deck area where the helm and the passenger seating is located, and the thing has windows in it, so you can look up through the marquee and see the wing when you're on the helm. But the important thing to note is that this marquee forms what they call an end plate for the wing mast and sail. That is when the wing mast and the soft sail portion are operating together, they sweep the top of this marquee so that the air pressure on the pressure side of the wing and sail cannot escape under the boom and ventilate the vacuum side. It's a very clever use of the device needed to shade the passengers in order to improve performance. And it's a substantial improvement. A lot of the lift on a wing is lost around the ends. And that's why we see in some of the airliners today that have paid a lot of attention to winglets on the ends of the wings in order to prevent air from escaping from the bottom side, the pressure side, and ventilating the upper side or the vacuum side. So the superstructure of the vessel is actually part of the power plant. It improves the efficiency of the hybrid wing. So we had a chance to see all of that. They had 20 guys in there working on it. many of these guys are graduates of the professional boat building schools in New England, and they have training in composite science. And reading the plans for this boat made me realize that you really do need to go to school in order to build this boat. It was just amazing, Joe. They had a beautiful computer-created drawings done by this guy, Eric Jolly, who is Paul Beaker's partner. He's the real CAD draftsman for Paul Beaker's inventiveness. And the drawings were just elegant. You could really see how to build the boat, but then you had to go to the table of laminate scheduling in order to find out how much carbon fiber to put on that part and in what place on that part. How much wow. carbon fiber. And then that whole thing is, again, vacuum bagged and cooked. You know, post-cured, just an amazing process to see what was going on there. And I had a chance to sit down with Tommy Gonzalez, Randy Smythe, and their chief builder, a guy named Wolfgang Chamberlain. And we have a nice interview with them. And I will bring it to the listeners when I get around to editing it, which will be as soon as I can, honest. These guys responded to our questions with really articulate statements, and I think anyone interested in the technical side of boat building will benefit from it, but they also emphasize the community that they're trying to create among themselves and their workers. And I had a chance to roam around on the shop floor for most of the day yesterday, and I talked privately with many of the guys that are doing the work, and they all had very positive things to say about what it's like for them to work in this place. They consider it to be a great opportunity for their careers as technical boat builders.
Well, so Jim, that is fascinating. I've got one question for you as we wind this podcast down. What do you think this means eventually for us guys out here, the regular folks out here in the sailing community? Is this technology going to trickle down to us somehow, or what do you see in the future for us?
Well, that's the intent. That's definitely the intent, that this rig will replace the usual aluminum mast and soft sails that we see on so many sailboats. This is the first practical rigid wing sail, and it carries a portion of it in a soft sail or fabric, let's call it fabric, it's really sheet plastic sail that can roughly double or triple the area of the wing. And that can be hoisted all the way to the masthead, and it has a square top, the gaff-headed appearance of so many modern sails. They're square on the top instead of being pointed because, well, all of that pointed area is really lost. It's just nothing but parasitic drag up there. And so, anyway, this wing will set a soft sail, and that's the unique thing about it. That was the basic uniqueness that allowed them to patent this invention. It has many other features, but that was the basic unique feature, that is that it also spreads soft sail. And the construction of the wings that they're building, they're so big, and it's also they're also going on racing boats, boats that are intended to sail at extremely high speeds. Because of all that, there's a great deal of technology invested in reducing their weight without reducing their cost. But the door is wide open for detuning the hybrid wing sail to the point where, I'm really expecting to be able to put one on my Windrider.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
That's really what they want to do with it, or they want to license others to do with it.
Yes. Yes.
And there's another aspect of this boat that I haven't told you about, Joe, and that is that this 50-footer is going to be foil-borne. Well, so is the 40-footer, but the 50-footer is intended for a new type of T-foil that I had never seen before. And I don't want to go too far in describing it without talking with Tommy Gonzalez, but let me say that it's the most advanced foiling system that I've ever seen, and the most sensible. I mean, it really does make a lot of sense. And they're now starting to produce the foils for the 50-footer, and of course, the design of the foils is just outlandish. I had a chance to see where they had cut one open, and I looked at the drawings to see how they're constructed, and they have to accept such enormous loads, because what happens, Joe, as I've said before about hydrofoils, these T-foils, when the boat gets really going and the wind pressure in the sails tries to make the boat heel, the foil on the downwind side of the vessel holds the vessel up above the water, and the foil on the upwind side actually pulls down. It doesn't lift, it lifts down, and thereby causes the boat to sail dead flat in any wind force. Because one of the things that Randy has emphasized in our last week's talk is that adjusting the amount of power that one applies to the vessel with the wing is so much easier and so much quicker. It's instantaneous depowering by simply allowing the wing to weathercock. And so we're on to something here that is, I think, absolutely astounding. Because this wing is buoyant and sealed, it can prevent the vessel from turning turtle if capsized. If you have a knockdown, the buoyancy of the wing itself is to keep the craft from turning all the way over. And they are now working on a system that's similar to that developed by Jan Gujon for the G32.
Yes.
That if the boat is lying on its side with one hull way up in the air and the masthead in the water in a stable position, they're working on the arrangement to incline the mast so that its buoyancy cranks the boat back around on its feet and then proceeds to hoist the mast back up into the sailing position.
Wow.
Now, that's been done with the G32. Mm-hmm. As you know, my son Russell has one, and he's
yes.
capsized it twice, once on purpose and once by accident because of a gear failure.
Right.
And both times he was able to rewrite the boat. So this system can be made to work, probably can be made to work, even with much larger vessels. And so now, Joe, what we've got in a multi-hull, hey, hear this, brother. We've got a boat that's not only unsinkable, because it's made of buoyant materials, and even if you tear it apart, the pieces won't sink. Not only is it unsinkable, but it is self-rescuing. It can be made to put itself back on its feet. And that right there is the fourth ingredient. I see this whole project as having three phases. One is the wing. It's really only a small part, but a critical part of their program. One is the wing. The second is the hydrofoils. And the third is electronic flight control talking to the hydrofoils. And they're working on that, too. They plan to test all of this stuff with prototype number 3, whereby the boat has a computer and a radar or a LISAR, laser radar. Who knows what the system is really going to be composed of when it comes down to the end, you know, the so-called beam-forming technology that they're using now to make self-driving cars. There's absolutely no reason why this vessel cannot read the approach of a wave and talk to the hydrofoils in such a way as to guide the boat to fly over the wave instead of crashing into it. Big waves, even big waves and even big vessels. So as I see it, this program is definitely a waypoint in nautical history. The technology is almost on the shelf, and the challenges are far less than what we faced with the early aircraft. And I just think that the know-how that these guys are developing is going to be with us for generations, and it'll definitely keep advancing all during that time. But this is the genesis right now. This is it.
Wow, Jim,
I'm really thrilled.
This is fascinating stuff. I feel like in this CaperCast, we ran the gamut. We went all the way from backyard builders knocking stuff out in their backyard, all the way now into you've taken it into space age boat building here, and we got to hear it. And we thank you for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you, Joe, but I've got one more tale to tell.
One more tale.
Yeah, uh-huh. The real bookend on the old time is that we then went to the Herreshoff Museum and had a chance to closely examine the Amaryllis, Nathaniel Herreshoff's catamaran from the 1870s, and it was far more advanced than I expected it to be. Extremely narrow hull forms, 30 feet long. It looked to me like the slenderness ratio in the hulls was like 16 to 1, which is really up there in the racing class these days. And it was wide, much wider than the Woody Brown boats, for instance. A very powerful boat. But poor Nathaniel did not have our building materials. The hulls of this craft were built in the so-called Carvel fashion, that is, planks over frames, screw-fastened over frames. And that construction is like, you know, building a big wooden basket. And baskets, you can twist a basket, and it'll creak and all of that stuff, but not if it's a waterproof basket. It won't take long before you scrub the caulking out from between the planks and all of that in order to make a truly modern catamaran. Herreshoff needed, well, what we started with was plywood or some other isomorphic material that has the same strength in all directions. And the hulls of Amaryllis would not take twisting. And, of course, the cross beams in a multi-hull exert a great deal of twisting on the hulls when the, as Randy says, when each hull tries to walk its own water, the whole platform twists. And the cross beams in Amaryllis were attached to the hulls in such a way as to hold the craft together as a catamaran without twisting the hulls. And it also, of course, allowed each hull to walk its own water, which we are beginning to learn is the way to make them faster. So I found our whole experience at the Herreshoff Museum to be quite a revelation, and we found a docent there who, a guy named Bill Beardsley, who had been working there for years and really knew the whole Herreshoff story. He took us through many of the sheds that march up the street of the old Herreshoff Manufacturing Company, and showed us the progression of the technology that Herreshoff developed. And he is no doubt still the dean of American yacht design. But what's going on today, I think probably Paul Beaker will be regarded in the same light one of these days.
Wow.
We'll see. So we had this wonderful 1870s bookend on a thing that now is just leaping into the future. It was quite exciting.
Wow. Well, we look forward certainly to your next report when you go up there and to hear about how the catamaran sails. That'll be very exciting, and we'd love to see a video. If you can get video of that to go along with the podcast, that'd be terrific.
Yeah, I think we'll definitely be able to do that. At least at the moment, it looks like we'll be able to do that. Maybe in a couple of weeks, we'll be able to get the material, but it's going to take us time to edit this stuff.
Sure,
I want to bring the listeners the highlights of the interviews that we had with the principals, with the people that are doing this. I want to do that, but I'm finding, Joe, that it's a lot more work to edit a field recording than it is for me to just sit down and tell a story into the mic.
Sure.
It's a lot more work. It takes a lot more time, so I'm going to have to ask for our listeners' patience, and I'm also going to have to offer my thanks to those who have helped us be able to afford to go do this. The travel costs have eaten up our operating budget, we're going to be in trouble if we keep this up. Scott Brown and I have both been diving into our own meager treasury for years in order to put the Outrig project together. But in order to keep up with what's happening now, man, we really need some help. So anybody that feels like chipping in on this stuff, we're here to say thank you. And I'm also saying thanks to the Commodore of the Northwest Multihull Association for sending me that T-shirt, the longest surviving multihull association in America, 50 years.
Wow.
He sent me a T-shirt, and I'll wear it proudly next week at Cedar Key.
That's great. We look forward to hearing your report from Cedar Key, and I'm sure that one's going to be maybe not so space-agey, but just as exciting.
Okay. All right. So thanks, and again, thanks to the listeners for putting up with the very sporadic nature of this report. We're doing the best we can, okay?
Thank you.
Fair winds to all. Sure. Bye-bye.